for February 21st, 2008, and this is our last scheduled meeting at this time. This is an informational meeting only, and really pleased that we have my metro counselor, Rex Burkholder, here today to talk to us about CO2 reduction through urban design. And we have some guests, actually. Representative Bart Hearn has joined us, who's chair of the Revenue Committee. That we worked very closely together on several bills during the interim and or last session, and also during this interim, we worked together on the Betsy. So, Rex, why don't you come up? And are you bringing anyone with you, or you're solo today?
All you get.
They let you out by yourself. Thanks for coming here all the way down to Salem.
Great. Well, thank you very much.
And for the record, just make sure you identify yourself.
Rex Burkle, Metro Councilor, District 5. And that is the northern half of the city of Portland. Approximately, there's 6 metro councilors elected by district and 1 council president. Our key role that was given to us by the citizens of the region in our charter that was adopted in 1992 is to plan for the future of the region and to maintain the quality of life for our current generation, future generations. They didn't use the word sustainability, but that's kind of what they're talking about. Metro manages urban growth in the region in a cooperative process with our fellow cities, 25 cities, parts of 3 counties. And we also help plan our transportation investments in the region through the Joint Policy Advisory Committee on Transportation. We are a metropolitan planning organization, 1 of 6 in the state. So land use and transportation are us in the area.
Can you bring the mic a little bit? You can move those mics.
Okay.
Because we're having a hard time.
Are they? I don't know if this is...
Mic on?
Does it sound like it's on?
Okay.
I think the whole volume in the room is low.
It's
or off.
We can hear. Can you guys hear me on the mic?
Yeah.
So why don't we sit at ease for a minute?
Sit at ease? Okay.
Metro Councilor Rex Burkholder, take it away.
Okay, well, I'll try to speak up so everybody can hear.
Well, no, they can move up if they want to hear you.
Okay, you can move up. I used to be a high school teacher, so I move up forward here. This, and as you know, climate change will probably be one of the key issues, or I think will be the key issue for the next 100 years in terms of how do we, as a society, adapt to these major changes. I had the privilege, I guess, of serving on 2 commissions that the governor appointed on global warming. The first, the Climate Change Advisory Committee, and then the Climate Change Integration Group, which occurred. Is that one working?
Try it.
Yeah. Does that sound any better?
No difference.
No. Okay, I think we're just turned off. And part of why I said that was that the information we got was actually very disturbing and very difficult to absorb and to think about how do we actually make the kind of changes that we're looking forward to or that we expect to occur because of climate change. And the numbers we got actually were, early numbers were actually a little bit, I think, more conservative in terms of the possible impact than was currently thought. So it is a major issue that we're facing, and I'm here today to talk a little bit about the experience of the Portland region and looking at the CO2 emissions budget there and what's been happening with our changes in land use and transportation as 2 things. One is to help you think about how do you actually turn into actions the goals that were set by your body last year in terms of reductions in carbon dioxide emissions over the next 20, 30, 40 years. How do you turn those into actions that actually make a difference? Oh, did I hear Sam?
Yeah.
Okay, great. Don't have to yell so loud then. How do you actually turn that into actions that make a difference? Because I think it's going to take some state leadership in the areas of land use and transportation in particular to help us get to that point. And these are things that we can do here that aren't reliant on international accords or national agreement or even, you know, to make these things happen. So I think we can do some things here, and let me go through this a little bit. Good, it works. This chart here just talks about the growth in vehicle miles traveled, okay, VMT, that will probably be the one jargon I'll be using here, which is vehicle miles traveled. And this is looking at the emissions that we project to occur on a percentage basis over the next 25 years or so. The growth in vehicle miles traveled that we predict in this country, if we don't change our behavior, will get us, and if without changes in technology and such, will get us to that red line there. So you see here at 60% above today's levels, which is actually about 80% above 1990 levels. This is national numbers, okay? If we get the improvements in fleet mileage, which is the green line, those are projecting out that 35 mile per gallon fleet average coming online over the next 20 years. And that saves us about 30%. Okay, that's great. But we're still not down even to today's levels. If we have the CO2 levels here, if we do our improvements in capture of CO2 emissions through this process of some kind, we can capture a bit more, improve our fuels, having lower carbon fuels. That gets us down to that purple line. So we're at actually 10% below today by 2030. Obviously, that's not the goal that we have set, and it's certainly not the goal that we think we need to meet in terms of actually doing, making a difference in climate change. It doesn't even get us down to 1990 levels. Okay, so this is part of the question is, can we solve this through technology? The fact that we are basically in transportation, which is 40% of our CO2 emissions and about 33% or so of the nation's CO2 emissions come from transportation, it's a key contributor to CO2 emissions. And we're looking at this and we're barely making a dent with all the best technology that we can imagine today. And that is because the current process is that we will continue to drive more and more and more and more. And what we end up with, and this is the scariest person on our committee, was a soft-spoken professor of forestry from OSU. Dr. Ron Nielsen is the national fire forecaster for the U.S. Forest Service. Here in particular, forest fires, we know that's a major impact of global warming, is increased forest fires. And the amount of money and the amount of damage that would be caused as the temperatures rise and our forests dry out is a pretty incredible number. And that's why I use this as kind of the alarmist piece here. But there will be many other impacts on our communities. And here, actually, less than other places. What's kind of interesting is the regional mapping of climate change has been improved. It shows the Pacific Northwest actually affected fairly minorly. But we will be impacted a lot by the rest of the United States, the southeast and southwestern United States drying up, having more droughts like they're experiencing today. Last summer, Phoenix had 30 days over 110 degrees. The southeast had about, I don't think it was like 6 to 10 inches of rain instead of their usual 60 to 80 inches of rain. Maybe anomalies right now, but the trend is more and more like that. Those people will want to move someplace where it's not quite so bad.
Rex, I think.
Yes.
I'm sorry to interrupt, Rex, and thank you, Chair. But if you go back to that first graph, can I just clarify that the line that it says CO2, that reflects what would happen to CO2 emissions if we did the red, green, and purple lines.
Okay.
Is that correct?
I believe you're right.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. So assuming those sort of technological improvements that allow us to increase miles per gallon and decrease greenhouse gas content of fuels, but also assuming increased vehicle miles traveled, we'd have a sort of net positive increase of CO2.
Yes. Okay. Well, thank you very much, and thank you for correcting that presentation on that. I got cut out by another school teacher.
Well, Madam Chair, while we're on that point,
if
I may. I'm not certain I understand the science we're dealing with, but I'm going to ask a question that suggests my understanding. In order to actually take on the global warming issue in terms of remediation, we have to get below zero on CO2 emissions, don't we? In order to reduce the CO2 in the air?
Well, the goal is we want to look at stabilizing the concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere at a level that doesn't cause a major increase. And I believe the science is, if I recall from the committee meetings, the science is that the current rate we have, we're going to have a constant growth to a certain point, even if we institute a lot of controls. And at that point is what we think, we will still have to make adaptation, because there will be changes caused by that, but we're hoping that we stabilize, and this is the intergovernmental panel on climate change, looking at a 2 degrees Celsius rise in general Earth temperatures as being something that can be acceptable. There will be major changes, but they won't be the disasters that occur. So the goals that are set by that, which is 80% by 2050, or 75 to 80% by 2050 below 1990 levels, that is to stabilize the world temperature at 2 degrees Celsius above what it is today. It's going to be a very long-term, probably centuries, process of actually seeing that go down below that. But the idea is that we want to, what is the realm of the possible and the realm of the acceptable in terms of the impacts.
Thank you. That's very helpful.
Thank you.
Okay, and thank you, Representative Cannon, for correcting me on that one. Okay, so what is hopeful about this? Okay, that's what I want to talk about. This bunch of spaghetti up here, colored spaghetti, are rivers or cities about the size of Portland throughout the country, and they include Kansas City, Cincinnati, Riverside. That's why I said river. I read that word. Milwaukee, Wisconsin, Fort Lauderdale, Norfolk, Sacramento. And what you'll see here, the general trend is the vehicle miles traveled per person are increasing in every one of these cities. The wiggles are usually local economic impacts. If your economy slows down, people will have less money, they drive less. The Portland line, which we made big so it's easier to see here, shows that in Portland region, we're actually seeing a drop in the vehicle miles traveled per person. Okay, which is very unusual. We're already at about 19.3 today is the average. It's below this. This goes through 2001. It's about 19.3 vehicle miles traveled per day per person in the region. The national average is approximately 26 miles per person per day. And so that shows you there is something going on in Portland. That's what I want to talk about. People are driving less in Portland region, and this is why I'm using Portland as a shorthand for the metropolitan area, because this is including, and our numbers actually include, most of these numbers actually include the Clark County part of the region, because they're based on the standard metropolitan statistical area. This is a particular Portland number itself, which is looking at the provision of bicycle lanes, which is the bar graph here, and then the actual, what the ridership rate is, and this is based on how many people cross the bridge a day as our proxy for the total numbers. They actually have, the City of Portland's been doing surveys around the city on the street basis, and seeing some neighborhoods where the auditor did this, actually a survey of households, and found in some of the inner neighborhoods of Portland, over 10% of the population says that the bicycle is their primary mode of transportation. That's going to work, work trips, and it's up to 28%. It's their secondary. Those are that 18% of the people that say, it starts raining, it gets dark, I don't ride my bike. I ride during the good weathers. And we're seeing this is a massive shift in just the last few years in the Portland area. Our transit usage is actually pretty high, too. If you look at all the cities to the left here of Portland, they're all the larger, older cities that were built around transit, around rail, around streetcar, around subways, and they're much denser also than Portland. And you see that our sister cities, the newer cities, especially in the west, our transit ridership is quite a bit higher, too. And you know, we have a great transit system, but it's not... That's not the only reason why the transit system. It's not because we invest the dollars in it, but it's also because it's practical to use it, and I'll get into that. And here's what the key is that the development in the Port Metropolitan area is much more likely to be urban development than most other parts of the country. The light blue line, or turquoise, I guess it's light blue on your there, is percent of development that has occurred in areas that you'd consider urban. Not just because it's zoned urban, but because the densities are urban densities, which are usually over 10 dwelling units per acre minimum. Is there a suburban? You see the light blue there, and then you get down into exurban and rural. So the land use planning system in Oregon, and that's what this is the land use planning system in Oregon has directed growth in areas where you have the densities that allow mixed use, that support mixed uses, that support walking, biking, and transit. And so these are the things that contribute to why people drive less in our area, and therefore emit less carbon dioxide. And this is the crux here. We haven't done a region-wide inventory yet. We're just starting that process right now. But a major part of the region, which is the Multnomah County area, which includes the city of Portland, they have actually been tracking this since the mid-90s. They've had a climate action plan since the mid-90s that are aiming to meet Kyoto protocols over time. And the two important numbers are where we started in 1990, that there was about 16.5 tons per capita equivalent, metric tons per capita, and they've dropped to about 14.5, and that's a 12.5% drop in per capita in CO2 emissions. Now, these calculations include household emissions as well. So this is looking at energy used in homes. And Portland has had and Multnomah County, in addition, has had a home weatherization program for a long time as part of the energy conservation. It wasn't designed, and many of these things, as you'll see, weren't designed to reduce CO2 emissions. Reduction of CO2 emissions is a good positive side benefit that we're discovering to the idea of how can we get people, how do we allow people not to drive as much? How do we give them more choices? How do we help them save money by reducing their energy consumption? These are the policies that have led to this. And so they're policies that have multiple benefits, and that's another good thing to look at this. It's not necessarily a sacrifice to say, let's reduce our CO2 emissions. CO2 emission is a result of burning energy and result then of spending, burning money. And can you somehow get people what they need, housing, transport to their jobs, at less cost by having them burn less and therefore create less CO2? The Portland Metropolitan Region has a growth concept. This is part of that charter that said develop a 50-year growth plan for the region. And so there was a lot of scenario planning done, which went out to the public and said, here's how we're currently growing under state land use rules, and is this acceptable to you that we grow this way? And then they had different models of density inside, having more development outside, have better transit connections to other cities in the region like North Plains or Morrell or Woodburn, and various models, and they came up with kind of an amalgam of that said, let's maintain the urban growth boundary pretty tight. We did expand at 20,000 acres a few years ago, so it's not a line in the sand, but keeping that pretty tight and then concentrating development of what we call centers and having all those centers connected by high quality transit. And the dark line here is the lines that are connecting most of the centers here. This is our high-capacity transit system. Actually, this is the light rail. There's actually opening up very soon is the West Side Commuter Rail, which actually connects on the west side, connects down from Beaverton, Washington Square, down to Wilsonville. So it's actually going to be part of it. Doesn't show up here. So this plan was to focus development inside. Again, it wasn't a plan to reduce CO2 emissions. The plan was, okay, we don't really want to sprawl and fill up the whole Tualatin Valley and move down to Salem. We want to have a community where people can get around and we can protect farmland. What we found, though, we run through these models, and this one here looks just not very clear. Unfortunately, the color to gray and black and white hasn't really worked that well in this one. But what this does shows you the development, where does development occur when you have this? And this one here is just showing the increase of urban development in locations around the urban growth boundary. Now, I just want to warn you, some of these are based on census tracts. So when you look around the edge, they can show you the census tracts are very large, and they go outside the urban growth boundary, which is the black line here. But the development is actually occurring on the inside of that. And so it shows you that we are getting high levels of development inside the urban growth boundary in these areas. And these other charts show a little better. Now, here's single-family housing demand. Traditionally, in American cities, especially western cities, where is all the single-family development? It's on 600,000-acre developments outside the urban core, and they just march across the landscape. Because even for single-family, we're seeing most of the single-family housing demand occurring within the urban growth boundary and filling in the areas. But also multifamily, we're seeing lots of multifamily going in. The lower right-hand corner is an area which seems a little bit on the edge, but that's the area body, and that's called Damascus. It's about 12,000 acres. We added the urban growth boundary a few years ago. Here's our projection of, relative to a base case, how the development would occur. And obviously, that area is not developed at all today. A few scattered rural home sites, and it will grow into a center and into a full part of the region. But you can see here the concentration of multifamily housing. And if you had the light rail lines here, you would see that a lot of that's right along those light rail lines, and people taking advantage of it, the market taking advantage of that. There's also a big demand for folks who are needier or less well-heeled parts of our society. That there's a lot of demand here for people who are lower income, elderly, or single households in those areas as well. You're seeing a lot of shift towards the inside. And we actually have some numbers showing a major reinvestment of people in the inner city of Portland and areas like Beaverton, Hillsboro, where you're seeing a lot of development there. The market and the prices are going up there too, or the values. I'd rather use the word values. And that shows the market is actually demanding people will pay more to live where it's more convenient, which is good for us and on this issue, because people will actually use less energy, therefore burn less carbon to live there. Here's just a comparison about some of the parts of the region in terms of looking at the physical design, because it's not perfect in the Portland area. As you know, we have a lot of areas that were developed in the 70s and 80s that were very much auto-dependent, subdivisions separated from the commercial areas, difficulty for kids to walk to school and such. And we, our policies are looking at how do we turn those around for a variety of reasons, but carbon dioxide emissions will be a piece of this. But this is comparing various parts of the region and looking at the percentage of trips that people take using the automobile. And anywhere you are that you have good transit and mixed use, whether it's in a Hillsborough, the older part of Hillsborough near the light rail with its grid street network and the old downtown, you'll actually see a lot less automobile use by the people who live there. And the two colors are basically low-income versus higher-income residents. Driving is a factor of income many times. One, you might have two workers in the household. The other one is that you just have the income, you can afford it, and you don't make those choices quite as much. But you'll see here that in, depending on the parts of the region, you do get, based on the urban design, you get different travel behaviors. And that's the key message I want to give you today, is urban design, how you create your city, how it's laid out. Can your kids walk to school? Can you get to a grocery store in a short trip, even if it's in your car? Is it a half mile away or is it 10 miles away? That design makes a huge difference on people's behavior. We also have found that people save money. Joe Cartwright, who's an economist in the Portland area, he did a calculation based on that VMT difference I told you about between our city and comparable western cities. It's just a few miles a day. But that adds up to about $1.7 billion in real dollars that stay in the pockets of people in our region that they can spend on something else. And if you include their time value, he figured out the time value, it's about $2.6 billion. And you can say, okay, you're going to commute to work, is that 20 minutes really worth a day that you save by driving less? Is that worth money? But that, he calculated it's $2.6 billion, but the real dollars are $1.7 billion that stay in the Portland metro area instead of being shipped to Saudi Arabia for fuel or to Tokyo for a new car. We also do other things to reduce driving, not just the urban design piece, and this is a key thing here for you to look at. We use Betsy credits, which are very important to us, to fund our driverless, to fund some of our programs like Carpool Match Northwest. You have directed the State Department of Transportation to spend money on transportation demand management programs like Driverless Save More. It's a very small amount of money, but we see this program, which is a mass marketing program combined with some individualized marketing programs. We see people making big changes in their driving behavior just through advertising. We think that, why should government advertise? You got a service, people should just expect to use it. But if you think about the advertising industry that spends billions of dollars to get people to adopt a certain new behavior or buy a new product, then we need to do the same thing. We need to encourage people to change their behavior through actually letting them know that they have choices. We also do transit-oriented development. We actually take a little bit of the federal dollars that the metro region gets, about $2 million a year, and use it to push the market a bit in areas where we want to have higher density mixed-use development like this development here in Gresham. And we use it to make the difference between what the current market would pay on rents or on per square foot purchases or retail rents. And we make it so that it's possible for them to do that. The best example I love is Hillsborough. There was a senior housing project being proposed, and they could afford, based on the income they'd make through renting out their units, a three-story building. And so what we did, we put $100,000 into that building. It was right on light rail, and they put an elevator in. And now, being able to put an elevator in, they went up two more stories, increased the number of units by 40%. Perfect market share. It's your elderly folks who want a nice walkable environment with good access to transit, and this is the way. And we actually justify the dollars through a formula that shows the trips that aren't taken because people live in those environments. And we've had outside collaboration by Portland State University, for example, that actually goes in before and after surveys about people's behavior. And we need to do that to prove to the federal government that we're spending their money wisely. And we've had this impact that lowers driving. Just about finished here. We have a new regional transportation plan that we are redesigning. I encourage you to take a look at what we're doing and encourage the Oregon Department of Transportation to think about how they do their transportation planning. We start out with saying that the world has changed, that the world with global warming, with energy, which I don't know if you noticed that fuel oil or oil closed at over $100 a barrel yesterday. When I started talking about the transportation plan and these issues, it was $70 a barrel, and everybody said that's not an issue, price of energy. It's just artificial that it's that high, will drop to 40 in a year or so. It's not going to drop. It may fluctuate, but it's always going to be higher and higher, and that's money in our citizens, coming from our citizens' pockets, that we need to be very careful about. That, and then the fiscal issue, which you're very aware of, in terms of do we even have enough money to maintain what we have? So we started with that and then talked about, well, what kind of outcomes do you want? When you make those investments, not to get a bigger road or to get a light rail, it's actually to change your community for the better. And so these are outcomes which I'm not going to go into. Some are how we do things, some are what we do. But we changed this to an outcomes-based system, and we're still in the middle of that right now because we have to change how we measure success. Before, it was based on, do you get more cars through an intersection in a certain amount of time, or how many transit boardings do you have? But we want to change that to say, what's the impact out there? Climate change is a key piece of this. No one's done this before in terms of actually looking at CO2 emissions and how do you rank transportation projects through that. That's part of the process we're working on as well. So just to summarize, the 2040 growth concept, which is Oregon's land use planning, just kind of on steroids, because the region said, let's do a little bit more than even the land use planning system told us what to do. In one, we've seen a drop in average travel distance. We have this increase in average residential density through this. And the cost of infrastructure per dwelling unit has dropped, too, considerably. This is another fiscal, the fiscal health of our local communities is a huge problem. This is the cheap and more effective way to achieve things, and it helps us with CO2 as well, as you saw. And then the person who put this together for me, one of my graduate student interns, he's a kind of sharp guy, and so he said, okay, what would it take to achieve these kind of CO2 emissions through other means? And he said, well, how about reforestation? And then he came up to say, if we took 27, a quarter of the area within our urban growth boundary, and tore down all the buildings and planted Douglas fir trees, they would have the same carbon reduction impact as our 2040 plan. Fun fact. If you want to share that with you. Thank you very much. I'm more than happy to answer questions. Before you, you have two pieces. One is a copy of the PowerPoint, and the other one is actually a chapter that is written for a book that's being put together by the California Transportation Research Institute that's going to include this. This is a talk, same talk I gave at a conference they had, and they're putting a book out on climate change and transportation. This gives you chapter and verse and the data behind the fairly rushed and maybe not 100% accurate representation description I gave you on the PowerPoint.
Okay. Great. Thank you, Councillor. Well, I have a couple questions, but we'll see if we have some. First, we have from the teacher, Representative Cannon. Can I see if he can trip you up on something?
No, not at all. Great presentation, Rex. Really, really enjoyed it. Really appreciated it, and all the work that Metro is doing. Is there some way to sort of, has someone very comprehensively looked at this question of cost? Because, of course, what some skeptics will say is, well, this is all well and good, but look at the price of housing in Portland and how quickly it's accelerated. Look at our taxes in Portland. And you get sort of this, and you presented some of the sort of counterarguments to that, I think, which are to say, well, as we reduce the time we spend in our cars, we're saving money on gas. But is there, someone looked at this in a really comprehensive kind of way?
Well, in the Portland region, yes, we have. And this is a little correction on that $1.7 billion a year. That's a gross amount. And then our economist, I asked him, well, okay, how about this housing value issue? Because our housing prices are slightly higher than other Western cities. And he did a calculation. He said, well, the net benefit is $1.5 billion to the region. That, yes, there is a little extra cost that comes out of the fact our housing values are higher, but that's still a net value. If you look at the cost, and this is a totally different issue than this one, but transportation and housing are the two major costs of any family's budget. And they typically average about 50% no matter where you live. And in our region, for example, if you live in northern Clark County, you're spending less on your house as a percentage of budget, but you're spending more on your travel because you have to travel more. and they still average out to about 50%. And the same thing if you live in the inner city, you're paying higher amount for your housing, but then you're spending less on transportation. Unfortunately, our institutions, like we go for a loan at the bank doesn't say what's your total cost for living where you are or where you want to buy your house. They say, well, what's the cost on the house and can you afford the mortgage? It doesn't matter if you have to buy three cars in order for your family to live there. They don't count that in. Actually, what's shocking is the car is seen as an asset, I guess because the bank can seize it if you don't pay up. But it's not seen as a cost to you. But we have done those calculations for us. The other issues, I think, there's been some work nationally done, and I think this is really key too, is to say what are those things that we can do that can reduce carbon dioxide emissions and which are the highest benefit for the least cost. And there are levels here. I heard a presentation by the president of the Natural Resources Defense Council, who works on this quite a bit. He kind of went through the whole thing you could do in your house to reduce energy consumption in a home. And he got to the end of the point and he said, well, if you got to a zero energy consumption home, okay, you will save less carbon dioxide than if you got rid of your second car. Okay, so if we look at what are the things that get the biggest impact, I think, on people's budget, as well as the carbon dioxide emissions, is going to be, can we make it so you don't have to drive as much, and can you get rid of that second car? Can you reduce your driving?
Just a quick follow-up. I mean, from the public standpoint as well, from public infrastructure standpoint, I think you touched on it, but I don't know if it's been fleshed out thoroughly how much money we might save as a state, as a region, as a city, in terms of what we're spending on to develop public infrastructure, right, where we have more contained urban spaces, we're presumably experiencing real efficiencies when it comes to road building or any of the other pieces of public infrastructure.
Yeah, and we're right in the middle of that right now, so I can't give you a definitive answer. The regional transportation plant is only one of the sub-plans of our re-looking at Region 2040 to see, because it's been 10 years since that was adopted. The question is it enough? Are we achieving our goals? And a key piece of this is looking at the infrastructure and the capacity of our local governments, but looking at the comparative cost. We know, in general, comparative cost, but we want to specifically get it down to and be really honest about it. Because if you do add dwelling units in already developed area, you do have to expand the sewers. Mm-hmm. You do have to do some other things. But we want to look at what are the real cost trade-offs between greenfield development and redevelopment in our already urbanized areas.
Thanks.
I think Representative Reed has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What's been your experience working with employers and incentives that might make it easier for employees and employers to use transit rather than single occupancy vehicles for their daily commute?
Well, a lot of the success has been working with employers through DEQ's
Eco Rule,
something commute options. I don't know what the E stands for. But so we actually fund transportation management associations is what they're called. We provide startup funding and then a smaller ongoing funding once they get going. I think we have, I forget the number, 16 of those in the region where they actually work one-on-one. They're a private nonprofit that works with a group of businesses in that neighborhood and helps them reach out to it and do the advertising, as I mentioned. They also take more action. Swan Island Transportation Management Association, for example, has worked to and advocated successfully to get bus service to Swan Island for the workers off shift and set up van pools to Clark County and other parts of the region so workers can have those choices as well. And then they just promote those alternatives. The passport program that TriMet has is a real key to that, which is the employers can buy passes for their at discount rates for their employees. And it's based on you buy passes for everybody and you figure that not everybody's going to use it. And so the TriMet gets reimbursed for what their costs really are instead of just what a cost of a pass is. But then the other part is many employers give this for free, and they get credits either through the federal, which I think is up to $60 a month, or maybe it's $100. I don't know if they changed it recently. They can actually take it as a tax deduction for the transit passes. And then some places use Betsy credits and others to help subsidize as well. And then there's just some policy changes, too. The Lloyd District, for example, which is the east part of the central downtown, they used to have about 10% non-car share. They added in the passport program, but more importantly, they put on-street parking meters. And they are now over 40% alternative modes. It was just too easy to drive there. And then the Lloyd Center retail businesses said, we have no parking for our customers. They show up, and when our lots are full, they have no place else to go. And so they militated or advocated that we need to charging for on-street parking so that they're not just full of all-day people who are there as employees. So you see, there's a combination of push and pull on these kind of things. And then those dollars are used to subsidize the Passport program, to pay for the Ferry Square, to pay for improvements, streetscape improvements to make it safer. They actually put medians in and crossings so people walk more in that community. Instead of getting their car to drive to lunch, they'll walk. So there's a variety of strategies that the business community has been very much jumping on because they see it increases the value of their location as well and improves their ability to attract and keep good employees.
Thanks. Thank you.
So, Rick, since we have the chairs of the Revenue Committee and the Transportation Committee here.
Thank you for attending.
We've got captive audiences. Can you talk a little bit about congestion cost pricing and the studies that Metro has done? And I sat in Representative Byer's committee, was it yesterday or 2 days ago?
2 days ago.
A presentation on the Columbia Crossing.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked ODOT about how they're incorporating congestion cost pricing into the proposed tolling. But there was you've done some pilot studies, and that was a piece that you didn't touch on, is using pricing mechanisms to reduce carbon outputs.
Well, it would certainly change people's travel behavior. And the work that we've done, it was in the late 90s, we actually had a grant from the federal government to do an analysis of congestion pricing. And the conclusion was, this will solve all our problems, but it's not acceptable to the public yet. Solving problems is that the experience around the world has been is that you can set the price fairly moderately, but that if you have a price system that is communicated to the public so they know how much it costs them while they're using the road, it actually changes people's behavior in a fairly monumental way. And it provides you, and then conversely, it provides you revenue to ensure that people have options so that you have a good transit system there so people can make choices in travel and also make sure you can maintain the facilities you have and then fix bottlenecks, because we do have bottlenecks. Even if you had a congestion pricing system, there will be key areas where you do need to make some investments. And the Columbia River Crossing, I think, is a key thing there when you look at that. To go from 6 lanes to a 12-lane structure, the extra 6 lanes are just for the bottleneck movements on and off there, which you probably heard enough about yesterday. I think we'll be going there. There are 5 American cities that have just received grants from the Federal Transportation Administration to set up congestion pricing pilots. San Francisco, New York, Seattle area, Minneapolis, and I forget the last one. They range from New York City, which is looking at actually having a congestion charge to come on the island, the whole island of Manhattan, or the lower half of Manhattan, to Seattle, which is looking at it's a bridge across, I think it's the 5 or 8 bridge, I forget the number of it, where they'll actually use it to rebuild the bridge and run a bus rapid transit system across Lake Washington back and forth.
Right. The 520.
Okay, 520. Okay, so they're doing that. San Francisco's looking at it as part of their reconstruction work on the Bay Area, on the Golden Gate Bridge, as a way to manage. And it's a combination of parking management and road pricing. So what we're seeing, and I think we're getting closer, because one thing is that people would willingly buy a guaranteed travel time. Whether you're a business and you need reliability, you want to plan on it, or if you're someone who's going to work and some days it takes you 20 minutes, some days it takes you 40, and so every day you take 40 minutes each way because you just don't know how much it's going to take, and you don't want to be late, so you sit in the parking lot for 20 minutes reading a book on days where the traffic's light. I think what we need to do is offer people, you will get X, Y, and Z, and one of those things that you will get is a guaranteed time to work. Or if you're a business, and actually the business community, everyone I talk to, they say do it tomorrow, because they are losing so much time and so much money because of congestion in our region. Our numbers a couple of years ago were about looking at $900 million a year in 20 years in terms of lost time, money, energy, everything else. But I think it has a lot of potential, and I think it also, and we had a fellow from Environmental Defense come through, Michael Rapogo, and he gave a talk that was titled solving congestion while reducing our environmental footprint. Because what you do, you get people who travel less because you think about it. You just don't drive as often. You use alternatives. You shop in your neighborhood instead of shopping across town. Those kind of behavioral changes. And he documented experiences in Stockholm, Oslo, London, Singapore, where you had cleaner air, less congestion, better transit use, all those positive things, less noise, all those kind of things that people say they want as quality of life issues. And you do it in a way that actually helps you pay for all those things, and do it in a way that doesn't, and actually improves your economy. So it's kind of a, there you go, it's a win-win-win. It's new, it's different, and it will take some time. The Columbia River Crossing will be a lesson for us all. Does it work? How acceptable is it? Do we toll both bridges or just one? There's lots of issues we need to talk about.
Okay, great. Thank you. Any other questions? Well, we really appreciate you coming here today, Rex, and I think we're going to be continuing this conversation, especially as we're looking at, for 2009, looking at a transportation funding package, and certainly I think many of us are going to be interested to see how we're going to bring that forward while also looking at reducing our carbon footprint, and I think that's going to be a big challenge for the state. But in order for us to meet our goals, it's something we'll be looking seriously at. So appreciate you sharing this great presentation with us today, and certainly encourage members to follow up with Rex if you want to, you know, follow on any of the recommendations that came out. I've seen many of the studies, including, I would highly recommend, if you want to send, it's a couple years old now, but that congestion study, it was cost of congestion to businesses in the Portland metro area, and it's a pretty compelling study. And so I certainly think that congestion cost pricing is something we're going to need to look at, because we can't build ourselves out of the congestion we have now. And I've been to two of the cities where it's been implemented, Singapore and London, and seen firsthand how it's changed the traffic patterns in those cities.
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity. Thank you, Chairs, from the other committees for joining us today. And we're at your disposal. I think we're the petri dish for trying a lot of these things out. And so we'd love to share our experiences, the failures as well as successes, and so that we can all do better here in Oregon.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. And next, we are going to ask the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife to come up. And Representative Barnhart, you're welcome to stay here if you'd like to hear about fish travel.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. But I had time for the first piece, and it has been very enlightening. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks for joining us.
Fish don't pay taxes.
Yes, we'll figure it out.
That was on the record.
Thanks, Ed, for being here on pretty short notice, and appreciate you coming today. I'd asked the department to come up and talk about how, basically respond to some questions about the relisting of the coastal coho. And I think you probably need to start with a little background information for all the committee members. We seem to have lost several committee members, so I apologize, but you have full attention for about 20 minutes.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Ed Bowles. I am the Fish Division Administrator for Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. And as Chair Dingfelder mentioned, coastal coho are once again listed as of this month. It's been actually about a 15-year saga this year, I think in October, that this actually began with a proposal or a petition for listing. And during the last decade and a half, there's actually been four different cycles of on-again, off-again listing for this these coastal fish, the coastal coho. They are listed right now, and I guess what I can do is go ahead and go through and give you a little bit of background of why that occurred, current litigation that's still in play. But perhaps most importantly is share with you kind of where do we go from here
and what does this mean not only for those folks participating in helping improve the status of these fish, but also the agencies and the governance structure that's been moving that forward, and perhaps even what this means for other species throughout the state. So we'll try to fit all that in. And I plan to just do this very much as a dialogue, so I'll keep my comments very brief, and we can just address questions. The chronology that I did hand out, I think Beth provided to you, is one from NOAA, the federal agency responsible for the listing decisions. That kind of shows you, and I'm not going to go through the whole list. If you have questions, we can certainly touch on it, but that shows you the kind of on again, off again saga that's been tied up in the courts, as well as scientific analysis. As far as the current litigative status of that, even though NOAA Fisheries did list them as of this month, they are still under appeal. The federal government probably has sometime this spring, definitely by April at the latest, to provide briefing to the Ninth Circuit on that appeal. And if they do actually follow up on that, then the state of Oregon is likely to join them and follow suit. We have been party with the federal defendants on this throughout this court case. There was not a motion to, or not a motion acted on for a stay, and so that's why the decision to go ahead and relist after the 60-day notice that the court had given to NOAA Fisheries, that's why that occurred this month. Now, that appeal could play out through this coming year if the federal government does pursue that, and the state of Oregon assumes that they will do that. So that's kind of the more legal status of the fish saga. Now, as far as what we've done internally within the state, we did probably the most comprehensive assessment of a fish status that's been done anywhere in the Northwest for coastal coho. Completed that actually in 2005. And that provided information to the listing decision that the federal government used in their consideration. That was what a lot of that analysis was part of what the court determined was arbitrary and capricious from the standpoint of not being the best available science. How that rolls forward poses interesting questions. The actual standards that we as a state established for the viability of these fish is actually much more rigorous than what other scientific teams working on recovery plans for other species actually included. So the bar was much, much tougher for these fish to clear when we did our assessment for the coastal coho. It'll be interesting to see how that aspect plays out when all the other science teams throughout the Northwest are incorporating much less precautionary criteria than what we did, which was determined not to be valid, the best available science. So I can't tell you how that plays out. I can just tell you that all the other listed species in Oregon has 13 of them now for salmon and steelhead. They all have technical teams of scientists working on the establishing the viability requirements for those species and then assessing where those fish are right now relative to those biological requirements. And all of those are based on the same principles that Oregon used in establishing its viability criteria. And in fact, it's called the technical recovery team. There's a technical recovery team for Oregon's coastal coho that is federally developed, but it's non-representational. It's has seven scientists on that participating for Oregon, the Oregon coast coho. And they are just in the process of releasing their viability criteria and status. That isn't out on the street yet, but it's not going to be substantively different than what our assessment found. There'll be some nuances, but it really is not going to move the bar substantially either way. So we appeared to have gotten it right from the science standpoint. Perhaps Oregon didn't get it right from the legal standpoint, but definitely from the science standpoint. So given that, we see no reason not to be moving forward consistent with all the other scientists in the region on how best to improve the lot of these fish and how best to move forward. We have a conservation plan that's based on these criteria and the management actions to address the limiting factors. We've already got that in place. My own Fish and Wildlife Commission for my agency has approved that as part of our native fish conservation policy. The state of Oregon, through the governor's office and the state agencies that are represented on the Oregon plan, have all adopted this. And so we have, as a state, moved beyond this listing decision quite effectively in function, because we're already implementing that plan. It was basically adopted, it's basically been a year since its adoption and moving forward, and that conservation plan is guiding our activities. I've provided you an executive summary of that plan. You can get the whole thing if you'd like off the web page. You can link it through the ODFW webpage or the State of Oregon webpage through the Oregon plan. And I'd like to accentuate that the key premise for how we want to move forward for coastal coho particularly, it is not changed from this and is unlikely to change. And that, I think it's identified, let's see quick if it's on
I'm going to interrupt you here a little bit. And can you explain to the committee a couple of questions? One, this is the state's conservation plan. Can you explain how this is going to interact with the recovery plan that NOAA Fisheries will put forward, number one? And two, the role that watershed councils and the work that we're doing through voluntary efforts will play in that, because that's one of the things I'm grappling with right now, looking at both the Willamette and Columbia River, is how our watershed councils also are involved in the recovery planning process or not. And that's, you know, since we're investing a huge amount of state dollars through the lottery in restoration efforts from watersheds throughout the state. So maybe you can talk a little bit about those different elements.
Chair Dingfelder, the conservation plan we have in place meets our state requirements. It's probably got 9 out of 10 of the building blocks for a federal recovery plan. Part of what would come in there is there would be an adjustment based on whatever this new technical recovery team, the federal scientists, come out with. We'll have to adjust things to be consistent with that if there are any inconsistencies, which will be fairly easy to do. Then from there, there's a couple of requirements in a federal recovery plan that are not in ours. Some of those are much more rigorous, fiscal analysis, several of the key elements. All of those will have to be done. We have struggled a little bit internally with how far we as a state will go on that. It depends on kind of how the recovery plan will be used. We have taken our scientists and our planners, and they're working on other plans right now, and to pull them back off to work on this is going to come at the expense of the Willamette, the Lower Columbia, the Mid-Columbia Steelhead, and others. And so we're hoping that the federal government steps up and takes our plan and makes it their own, and we will help them where necessary on that aspect. I'd like to address, Chair, your other question regarding how do we then implement our plan relative to the federal recovery plan. And I think the building blocks will be the same as what's in our conservation plan. And this gets back to that premise I talked to you about. It's on page 6 of that executive summary, kind of in bold italics. And this ties into the role of the watershed councils and others, but it's basically for coho, particularly coastal coho, habitat improvement, management improvement is the key to protecting and enhancing these. It's all about habitat. Now, much of the most important coho habitat is on private land. Well, over 90% of the key areas that we're focused on is private land for coastal coho. And we believe fundamentally that the best way to improve habitat on private land is through these incentive-based cooperative conservation partnerships with landowners, which the Oregon Plan is the vehicle for doing that through your not only the state agencies implementing through assistance to these landowners, but also through your grant process, through OLEB and the watershed councils, and all these bottom-up sort of infrastructure things that are in place from the Oregon Plan. These are the best way to actually implement these actions. Obviously, you need a governance structure to ensure they're focused on addressing the primary things that are ailing the fish for each area and that the money's well spent. But that is the avenue to implement that. I don't see any of that changing. It's our best way to get things on the ground. We still have a backdrop of a regulatory structure, state and federal, that will be in place. The enforcement and compliance with that is paramount, but the actual moving forward on restoration through these incentive-based cooperative partnerships is going to be very key. And I'd like to just go ahead with you.
You can go ahead.
Okay. The listing itself of becoming listed again, all of this was moving forward with a tremendous amount of, I'd say a remarkable amount of passion and enthusiasm when the fish were decided to be not listed. With the relisting, many of our key partners on the ground that have been spending in tremendous amounts of resources towards improving the fish, it really knocked the wind out of many of them. There has been an idea that if they contribute, if they partner up, put things on the ground to do good things for the fish, and the science bears it out, that they will actually be able to move towards not having the listing status there. And so that is something that we're working on as a state now, on how best to ensure that these partners recognize that we're still in the game, we're still fully supporting them, and that we still have a horizon of getting these fish delisted. But it's just not right now. And that's a tough message. We'll be working with many of our key partners. OFIC has been a key one that has been, let me just give you some examples. Coastal coho, on the backs of the Oregon Plan and these cooperative private incentive sort of contributions, has invested well over $100 million in restoration activities since the Oregon Plan began, well over $15 million in monitoring and evaluation. We don't have anywhere else in the state, and that's just for that group of fish. We don't have anywhere else in the state that this sort of aggressive action, this coordinated action, this commitment to monitoring and investing in dollars on the ground for fish is taking place. And so that was kind of our model that we wanted to use to move into the Willamette, the Lower Columbia, on into the east side. And having that wind taken out of the sails is we need to, as a governance structure, both the state agencies, the legislature, the governor's office, really work to ensure that those investments were well made and that that momentum is carried forward all the way through to 2014, when we have the reauthorization of the Measure 66 doing these good things in the watersheds. And this can be a potential hiccup in that cooperative relationship with the landowners.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks. I guess I'm a little bit confused. This ruling comes down that relists the coastal coho as an endangered species, and presumably that was on the basis of what plaintiffs were able to demonstrate to a court was required under the law. The result, for instance, and I haven't followed the case, but result of declining numbers or what's happening to habitat. And what I'm hearing from you is that the state plan, the state response to this issue related to the coastal coho remains the same, that they're not intending, and maybe I'm missing something. I know this is a complex issue, and we have national agency, and we have state agency, and we have all the private effort that the state's helping coordinate it, but that essentially, from the state's point of view, your response or to addressing this issues around this fish remain the same. And it's not clear to me why that should be the case.
Chair Dingfelder, Representative Cannon, it does sound like a bit of an irony or conundrum. The reason that we're moving forward with our existing plan is our conservation plan sets as its goal, its desired status for the fish, leaps and bounds beyond this somewhat, I'll call it somewhat cavalierly, this esoteric question of listing, no listing. We've established a goal that is, even under the worst of the ocean conditions, is more than double what these fish are now under bad ocean conditions. Under good ocean conditions, it's more than four times higher than what we would observe now. So our goal is already established through this conservation plan, well beyond this question of listing, not listing. The legal issue that took place in the courts was simply regarding that pivot point of should they be listed or not listed. It did not address what are the limiting factors, how much action, what is the best way to put action on the ground, and how far do you need to go relative to having healthy populations. That was not what was at issue in the court. And so our plan moves well beyond that. The actions are in place that are going to be the same sort of approaches used throughout the Northwest for other recovery plans. The limiting factors have been identified. None of that is disputed. And I reiterate that I'm not going to judge this per se relative to the legal decision, but the technical recovery team established for this group is basically coming in very substantively similar to where we landed with respect to the status of the fish and the viability criteria. So,
just a comment, and you can respond to it. But it sounds like a pretty narrow construal of the legal opinion of what the court meant when it relisted, because presumably the plaintiffs were suggesting, I would guess, they would not have even brought the case if they didn't feel like the state and other partners needed to step up and do more with respect to restoring this fish run. That it's not in fact enough to follow the plan, and therefore a relisting was appropriate because of some additional kinds of safeguards that it might provide. That's my sense of why a plaintiff would go to a court and say this fish should be in fact listed, because we want government and others to respond to it differently than they have been.
Chair Dingfelder, Representative Cannon, I won't speak to what the plaintiffs or other concerned groups will request in the recovery plan or with new actions. I can speculate that some want new regulatory structures, but the actual legal decision was simply based on evidence relative to listing or not listing. I reiterate again, our actual plan, nobody is disputing that it's primarily about habitat. We've taken actions already on hatcheries and harvest. And within our plan, our goals are pretty lofty. They've set sights on actually doubling the amount of high-quality habitat throughout the coastal basin. Huge, ambitious goal to actually achieve a doubling in the miles of high-quality habitat. If we're successful in that, the status of the fish populations will be vastly beyond any legal or non-legal decision regarding listing or not listing.
Excuse me just a minute. I think Representative Reed, are you being summoned?
I think all of us in the House are being challenged by Senators Atkinson and Ivakian, their effort to...
It looks like a motley crew.
Very sorry for the disruption. We were just picking on your junior member a little bit.
But we'll take a couple more questions, and then we'll let people go. I think there's a little... event going on that we're missing out on here, being serious about the plan that that you're going to put forward still has to, my understanding, still has to be approved by NOAA Fisheries, and that we don't know there will be a recovery plan that NOAA Fisheries will put forward, and the question, I guess, still is, you know, given that we're going down the same track that we did before the relisting, do you have a sense from NOAA Fisheries about whether or not they're going to say, no, here's all the things that you need to add? And you talked about, with the TRT, making some adjustments. So how are we going to show that that's adequate for...
The adequacy of the actual requirements of a plan.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, there are three or four elements that we didn't include in our plan that will have to be added in. We will work with the federal government if they need information from us to complete that plan for that federal plan. Most of the other example is the TRT. Criteria will be adjusted. Like I said, that's not going to change the plan substantively much at all, is my understanding. The actions that will actually be taken in there, because they vastly exceed any dispute relative to what's needed relative to viability, to go way beyond that, those sort of actions will be, I doubt they'll be contested at all. The real question comes down to, is the federal government or others going to ask for additional regulatory requirements within the plan? We'll have to see how that plays out. We do not plan, as a result of this listing, to propose additional regulatory requirements in a generic sense. We have not identified any within the state. If the different regulatory agencies are able to find opportunities for that or rationale for that, we certainly would support them moving forward with that. But right now, for Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, we've exercised all of our regulatory authority to make substantive change to hatcheries and harvest. So we've met, you know, those requirements. The basis of the plan, which is improving high-quality habitat on private land, we believe, as ODFW, will be best accomplished through these cooperative partnerships, incentive-based, with the private landowners, and we firmly believe that's going to be the key to success.
I think we have time for about one more question, and I think we'll probably end up continuing this conversation during the interim. Representative Cannon, I think, has a question. Are you going to be, as far as you had mentioned, by the way, resources and having to possibly shift resources working on other recovery plans, so are you going to, I'm assuming you're building your budget right now for 2009. Do you see needing additional resources to address the coastal recovery planning?
Chair Dingfelder, we do have a little over $1 million that we've used for recovery planning in the state, as well as matching dollars within the agencies to the tune of probably over $2 million. The hope was to try to put the recovery planning side of this to bed sooner rather than later, and not extend into the next session. It looks like we will have to probably do that. We'd hope to be into the implementation side rather than the planning side. I think it is fair to say, Madam Chair, that we will probably be coming forward with more planning dollar requests.
Representative Cannon, did you have a question?
Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, I appreciate the work that you and the department have done on these voluntary efforts in coordinating this plan, which is, I think, a good one. I guess my only question is, really, is it enough? And, you know, you look at the fact of my understanding, the first plan related to coho recovery dates to 1982, and the fish is not recovered. I mean, we continue to see loss, and so how do you explain that? And again, you know, how do you justify that the department is doing enough using all the tools at its disposal related to harvest, related to hatcheries, to do what needs to be done, and now what needs to be done under the Endangered Species Act?
Chair Dingfelder and Representative Cannon, we have, as I mentioned, probably the most rigorous monitoring and evaluation program anywhere in the state on our coast. It's as a result of the Oregon plan It is the envy of all of our sister states, quite frankly, and they are now adopting that. We're also adopting it more internally. So we do have our finger to the pulse of how the fish are doing. Being able to track changes in habitat improvement and seeing results in fish in short time frames is difficult. We are implementing actions. The key is being able to track over time whether or not those actions are actually, you know, turning the corner for the fish. Sometimes these actions will take decades to really see benefits. That's a work in progress. I'm not claiming that that evidence is in. But through adaptive management, we're committed to learn as we go. We are watching and listening to the fish. And if the fish are not responding, we're committed through our plan to adjust measures up to and including regulatory reconsiderations on that front if it's the best way to get actions on the ground for the fish. Right now, our belief is the best way to actually see actions on the ground in the areas that the fish need it the most, these lowlands and private land, is through these cooperative partnerships as that best avenue. And it remains to be seen if that works effectively, but we have the monitoring in place to do it as long as we don't lose that funding.
Right. Well, I think we're out of time for now. I really appreciate you coming here today, and I do think we'll be asking for updates for the remainder of the year so we can hear how the process is going, and certainly if you can keep us posted on the TRT process for this, it's very helpful. So thanks again for coming in such short notice. And
thank
with
you,
that,
Madam Chair.
I will close the informational hearing of the House Energy and Environment Committee, and we do not have any other scheduled meetings this week. So appreciate your attention.
Thank you.